The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today we'll be talking about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a gyre of marine litter in the central North Pacific Ocean. A quick Google search of the phrase brings up statements like, "The island is almost entirely comprised of human-made trash. Worse than we thought. Drowning in plastic. And the world's largest dump." So that sounds bad. But is there an island of garbage floating in the ocean? Is it media hyperbole designed to get otherwise lackadaisical readers to care at all about environmental issues? Is it, as it is with most things, something in between those two extremes? Miriam Goldstein, chief scientist on the Scripps Environmental Accumulation of Plastic Expedition, or CPLEX, will be on the air today to help us sort it all out. But there is one thing that's perfectly clear. This is episode 52 of Skeptically Speaking. That's 1 year of skeptical radio. 1 year of interviews with interesting scientists and other experts in their fields on everything from breaking research to the basics that we all need to know. 1 year of promoting the efforts of grassroots groups bringing critical thinking to the masses. 1 year of attempting to eradicate technical difficulties and mostly succeeding. In that time, we've seen the number of weekly downloads increase steadily, and we're now being rebroadcast on radio stations all over North America. And that, my friends, is thanks to you, our wonderful listeners. It's also thanks to the incredible number of people who have worked on the program over the past year. Sean, Josh, Jill, Jarrett, Mike, Grant, and Ryan. You guys have put in a ridiculous amount of work, and it shows. Thank you. And an extra special thanks to those of you who hang out in the chat room during the live broadcast. You have the patience of saints. So I'll stop fawning now, and we'll move to speaking up. We're speaking today with Greg Fish, a computer science grad student and science blogger whose work appears in Business Week, Discovery News, The Panda's Thumb, and other popular science sites and blogs. He specializes in writing about unusual cutting-edge science and promoting skepticism and sound scientific education. His personal blog is worldofweirdthings.com. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Greg.
Thanks. Thanks for having me here.
So you wrote to us wanting to discuss how sometimes transhumanists go too far. Explain, sir.
Well, technology is a wonderful field of study, and there's a lot of very interesting things being done with computers and with robotics every day. However, sometimes I think people go a little bit too far in how much they assume technology can do, and occasionally they tend to substitute the technological abilities that we see today for a kind of almost magic that would at some point in the future allow us to do, well, just about anything.
So an example of this is the supposed simulation of the cat brain that happened a few months ago. Can you tell us first, how was this research actually presented to the public?
Well, the research was presented to the public that IBM was able to set up a sort of simulation that exceeded the scale of a cat's brain in terms of how many neurons there were and the complexity of the actual processes taking place. That's not necessarily what was happening, however. There was almost immediately a reaction from experts who saw this saying that that's actually not, there's no way that this would actually work. One of the experts who was, I would say, the most incensed, to use the proper word for his reaction at this, was actually Henry Markram, who is working at another IBM laboratory, also trying to simulate neuron connections in brains. He basically compared what IBM has done to creating a cat neuron soup. And I've been able to actually get my hands on the paper which described how the simulation worked. And I have to say that I would actually agree with his conclusions. It was a rather brute force test of computing strength, whether a supercomputer had enough power to replicate a lot of neuron connections. But again, this was drastically simplified. It didn't really have any structures. It didn't really have anything that we would expect to see in a realistic simulation of the brain.
Okay, so you're talking about sort of the computing power of the brain, and they were presenting it as more of an intelligence, correct?
It certainly seemed like it, yes. And there's a lot of popular science blogs that jumped on it. I mean, Popular Mechanics was presenting it as IBM having had created an artificial cat brain. And IBM did not seem to protest.
So what is artificial intelligence then? Is it actually computing power or is it something else?
It's a combination of many things. Artificial intelligence is rather difficult to define, but essentially it involves a automated system being able to solve problems, being able to understand such things as context, being able to take a look at an image and derive information about what this image represents like we do. It involves decision making. It involves motivation. It basically involves taking what we understand as intelligence in some shape and replicating it in an automated artificial system.
See, that sounds very simple when you say it, but it seems like there's not exactly a consensus within the scientific community on what intelligence is.
I would say that there does seem to be a consensus about what factors are important in measuring intelligence. For example, things like strategy and creativity, being able to learn, those are all very important things in actually coming up with a framework of intelligence. However, the question becomes, how many of these things do you need to combine and how in order to create something intelligent, especially in an artificial way? We can take a look at something like learning in a computer based on artificial neural networks. And that's basically a process in which computers develop a statistical model of what information is important and what information is not that important, kind of in the same way that we do in our brains. They have inputs and outputs, and they weigh the importance of certain source of information based on their recurrence. So just like we learn by repeating things over and over again, computers can also assign more weight to a particular recurring piece of information.
Right.
One good study about this is actually a recent publication in PLOS Biology, actually, by a computer scientist and a biologist who've put robots through their paces using these artificial neural networks. And what they found was that giving robots some free rein and allowing them to sort of learn from their mistakes, bumping into walls, not getting the tasks quite right, and so on and so forth, they would be able to create behaviors that almost seem creative, that almost seem intelligent from an observer standpoint, simply based on the action of these neural networks. However, the problem is, does that necessarily constitute intelligence in and of itself? Does simply learning and coming up with a particular way to do something based on the circumstances or based on the requirements that were given them in the framework of an experiment constitute intelligence? It's sort of that becomes sort of a philosophical gray area. And another major philosophical gray area in artificial intelligence is whether consciousness and self-awareness is necessary for something to be considered intelligent or not.
So if that's a philosophical discussion, that makes it very difficult to answer.
Yes, having artificial intelligence be subject to philosophy makes it very difficult to define objectively in the form of requirements that somebody could actually create it, because everybody has a different opinion about it. For example, philosopher John Searle has an analogy called the Chinese room analogy, which tries to show that if you make a program that is sufficiently responsive to user commands, people could be fooled that it's intelligent, but really it's nothing of the sort. It's simply looking through a database of answers and giving you the right one based on the context, on the query that you supply it.
Right.
And another one of his arguments is saying that even if you were able to figure out how to put together something conscious from inanimate object, it still wouldn't be truly conscious because it lacks, well, something. It apparently will lack some sort of a correct spirit or some sort of a correct analogy to biological forms. Essentially, it's this idea that there has to be something natural about intelligence. There has to be something biological, and it's impossible to replicate it in a truly mechanical form. On the other hand, you have philosophers who will say, well, no, that's not necessarily true, because how do we know that intelligence and self-awareness are not just complicated algorithms running in the background that we could simulate given enough time, given enough knowledge, given enough effort? And it's that latter side on which the singularitarians overwhelmingly seem to fall.
And we're definitely going to talk about the singularity in a moment. I guess what I'm wondering is, when we're talking about these kinds of fantastical stories with the cat's brain soup, which I think is a brilliant way to put it, it seems like the reporters could be partially at fault for reporting in the way that they do about them, with the flashy headlines and such. But wouldn't it also be that there isn't enough consensus or understanding around this issue? It's hard to get a straight answer in the first place, even if they are asking the right questions.
It seems to be a combination of basically all of these factors. For one thing, the reporters and bloggers and writers need to sell papers and need to generate page views. And, you know, I freely admit that I'm in the same business, and I've written a number of headlines that maybe were not quite as accurate as they should have been, because, again, that's part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's very difficult, even if you do ask the right questions, as you said, to really get a straight answer, because there's still no real consensus. It's still very much up for debate exactly how do we build an intelligence system, exactly what is involved. Do we need to start from scratch? Do we need to emulate a brain to do it? What actually needs to happen? And not every science writer, not every science blogger necessarily has the expertise to go into the details and really start asking some of the more in-depth questions. They also risk alienating their audience because, you know, after a certain point in time, it becomes a scientific discussion at such a high level that people don't necessarily want to follow it. They want to know what's going on, why it's relevant, and why it's important. They don't necessarily want to float in the realm of abstraction all day long. So while asking very detailed questions is very important for researching in order to actually summarize, in order to actually say what's going on and how, it can be very difficult to get to really boil down the question to a couple of paragraphs.
And a perfect example of this is what you already mentioned, the singularity. For those of our audience who have never heard of this concept, give us some background.
Well, essentially, it's a concept that's very difficult to define. It's rather vague, but it rests around the idea that at some point in the future, there will be a event in which technology will basically change our entire world and our entire worldview. How still remains unclear, but
right.
Something profound will happen involving technology.
And so what is sort of the evidence for this?
The evidence for this ranges depending on which singularitarian you seem to ask. In one way, the evidence that's presented for it is Ray Kurzweil's famous exponential curve, where a number of achievements throughout evolution are arbitrarily chosen and put on a logarithmic scale, which try to show that the advancements of evolution and intelligent species are somehow accelerating as we're moving forward in the future. And this is, of course, not exactly a correct way to do it, because what it does, it applies the kind of thinking you would see in engineering to biological processes, which will not necessarily follow the same rules. For example, the idea sort of seems to imply that intelligence is a natural product of evolution, when in fact, most biologists will tell you that it is not. It's a confluence of factors. It would be rather rare. We know that there are multiple species on Earth that involved different forms of intelligence. For example, we can say that dolphins are intelligent. We can say that squid are intelligent. We can say that whales are very intelligent. You know, very few people would argue that chimps have a very high level of intelligence. However, these species don't really seem to be mentioned on the exponential curve.
Right.
Another thing that seems to be missing from the exponential curve are technologies that haven't progressed at an exponential rate. Certainly computers have advanced very quickly simply because there's an overwhelming demand for more computing power, for greater ability to house and work with more and more complex applications and so on and so forth. But things like space travel seem to be in a stall, for example. A lot of the technologies that we thought would have by now in terms of space travel are really nowhere even close to moving off the drawing boards. They're still in very experimental stages. And in fact, if you take a look at Ray Kurzweil's charts, you will note that space flight is completely missing, which actually puzzles me to no end, because one would think that something like landing on the moon would sort of be important
in terms of
achievements of intelligent creatures, but that's completely left off.
So is there actually validity to the idea of the singularity, or is it more of a gray area?
Say that it's a gray area with some valid points. The valid points of the singularity, and I'm going to put this out there because one of the things that when I talk about the singularity from a skeptical standpoint, a lot of times I get comments saying, you know, you're not really being progressive enough. You're denying that technology seems to be advancing more and more. And that's true. We're certainly going to see amazing things coming out of technological advances in the next decades. We have cyborg technologies out there. We have incredible advances in supercomputing. We have experiments in which we can squeeze more and more and more processing power from future computers as well. So really, in terms of technology today, it seems that the sky is the limit. However, the part that I object to as a person who has worked with computers and who studies technology, I would object to the idea that somehow we're going to have some sort of a spiritual or evolutionary breakthrough with technology,
right?
Simply because it's muddying up numerous concepts that don't necessarily belong in the same room with each other. For example, the idea that technology is somehow a step in the evolution of humans is definitely more of a philosophical assertion than a scientific one, because we can have someone who is a cyborg. For example, a person who had a kneecap replaced or a hip replaced or had advanced technology implanted into his or her body, but this person is not going to pass on these traits to his or her offspring.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be an evolutionary change. One would say that the development of tools and development of technology can be seen as a byproduct of human evolution. But to say that we're going to advance on an evolutionary scale by using technology, it seems to be more of a personal opinion rather than a well-grounded scientific fact.
So in effect, you're telling people to be patient and be skeptical.
Basically, yes.
Okay, perfect. Thanks so much for being here, Greg.
Thank you for having me.
If you'd like to find out more about all of these topics, check out Greg's blog at worldofweirdthings.com. And if you out there in the real world have something to say or an event to promote, email us. We're at feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put speaking up in the subject line, write a bit about your chosen topic, and we'll get back to you as quickly as our inferior human bodies will allow. And we'll be right back after this.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, either through the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still hear the broadcast live on our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by clicking the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest, and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to those stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including Citywide LPFM 99.1 in Madison, Wisconsin, CILY Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia, CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia, CJAI, Amherst Island Public Radio, 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario, CLHI, Rosslyn Radio, 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia, Freethought Radio, and WPRR, Public Reality Radio, 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We have a quick announcement. The Society of Edmonton Atheists is having their annual general meeting on Tuesday, April 6th at 7 p.m. at the Downtown Public Library. You can visit edmontonatheists.ca for more information. And we have another quick announcement. You guys are wonderful. We have some incredible fans, and they just sent us a link from the chat room, and they've set up an anniversary page for Skeptically Speaking. It's brilliant, and I don't have time to read it all now, but I know it's posted on the Grassroots Skeptics website. You guys are awesome. Okay, tonight we have Miriam Goldstein on the line. Miriam is a fourth-year PhD student at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at La Jolla, California. For her thesis work, she's studying the effect of plastic debris on zooplankton communities and invasive species transport. She's the principal investigator on the CPLEX cruise, which investigated plastic debris in the North Pacific Gyre in August 2009. Miriam's popular writing has appeared in Slate magazine and in Open Laboratory, and she currently blogs at Deep Sea News. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Miriam.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch?
Well,
that's a big question.
Essentially, it's a really high concentration of small plastic particles that is floating around in the middle of the Pacific. There's actually more of these plastic particles out there than there are close to shore, say, off of Los Angeles, which is, I think, is the really surprising part about it.
So where exactly is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch located? Because the Great Pacific is a rather large place.
Well, before I answer that, I just want to quickly explain what the difference is between the North Pacific Gyre and the Garbage Patch. The North Pacific Gyre is a natural oceanographic feature formed by the westerlies or the jet stream and the trade winds, which basically push the ocean around. And then as the Earth turns, that water starts moving in a clockwise motion, which forms this big, slow whirlpool in the middle of the North Pacific. And that's totally natural. That's the North Pacific Gyre. The Garbage Patch is the accumulation of trash that is somewhere in the North Pacific Gyre, but we don't really know how much trash there is or what the full extent is. We do know where we went between Hawaii and California, about halfway between them both, had a really shockingly high amount of trash.
Okay, now you've said trash and you've said particles. Explain exactly what that means.
Well, I think there's a misconception in the media that there's this, you know, there's the eighth continent, there's like the garbage pile, and it really doesn't look like that. The ocean really just looks like ocean. And you can't really see that there's all this trash in there because it's all broken down into these particles that are mostly the size of your pinky fingernail or less. So when you put a net in there that's designed to catch small things like zooplankton, then you come up with essentially plastic confetti. And we found that it was just everywhere. No matter where we put the net into the ocean, we would come up with some of this plastic confetti. Now, sometimes there'd be more and sometimes there'd be less, but it would always be there. But what we didn't see was, you know, something that looked like a floating garbage dump with, like, plastic bags and bottles, like, as dense as the eye could see. We didn't see that.
Where did that impression come from, then? because that is the overwhelming impression of the Garbage Patch, is that it's basically this massive island that you can walk on for days.
It would be a lot easier to get there if you could walk on it. But instead, we had to take a boat. But I think it came from some enthusiastic but perhaps slightly misguided media coverage. There's a lot of pictures floating around the internet that say, oh, look at the Garbage Patch. And it is, I suppose, a patch of garbage. But those pictures that are very dense tend to be from either like right in urban estuaries or from developing countries without much infrastructure.
So now these misappropriated images that you're talking about, they've also ended up on the websites of environmental groups.
Yes, that's true. I try to send them nice emails when I find them. There's one satellite image that I am waging a personal vendetta against that purports to be of a satellite image of the trash. But actually, it's neither of trash nor of the North Pacific Gyre. It's actually a phytoplankton bloom, a tiny plants off of Japan in a big swirl. But it just got mislabeled somewhere, and since the internet is a big game of telephone, it seems to keep on being perpetuated.
So how often do you actually come across stuff like that? Mislabeled images?
Fairly often. A little bit less now. I think the facts are getting out there, but it does, I try to keep an eye on it, but I also still have to, do research, so.
Right.
I might be missing some of it.
So you say that popular media pick up these images and report on them. So what's the danger there?
Well, I think the danger is then that the actual facts, which are frankly appalling, become disappointing. If you're expecting to actually be able to see an island made of trash, then when the facts are that the plastic is totally permeating our ocean, but it's small, then that maybe doesn't move you to action in the way that I think that it should. I mean, the thing that surprised me at this cruise is we found plastic in every single sample, every single one, even off of California, even or off of Oregon. There was less, closer to shore and more in the gyre, but I have not looked at a single surface sample that didn't have a piece of plastic in it, and that out of 126 across about 3,000 miles. So there's a huge amount of plastic in our oceans, and that is just not what's supposed to be there. But they are these very small, hard-to-see particles. So I think it's dangerous to expect to see something that looks like a floating garbage dump, and instead you find these particles, and then maybe you don't care about plastic in the ocean anymore, when in fact that it really might be an important source of ecological damage.
So people go from sort of overestimating the issue to assuming it's not really a problem when they find out it's not real piles of whole trash.
I hope that people don't do that, but I do worry that that's the danger with setting up these sort of incorrect expectations.
Do you think there's some environmental groups that are doing that on purpose, or do you think that it's definitely one of those, it proliferates the internet with these mislabeled images and then they just repost them?
Oh, yes. I think it's totally an internet telephone game. Mm-hmm. So these sort of once, for example, that satellite picture got mislabeled by somebody sort of well-meaning but misinformed, it is, once it got out there, it's labeled as the North Pacific Gyre, it's been impossible to completely, put the internet cat that in the internet bag. And I think we see that with a lot of scientific issues, for example, that you deal with on this show, like for misinformation about, for example, vaccines and climate change and so forth.
You understand.
Yes.
You understand this show.
I think it's pretty common. And it's both the glory and the downfall of the internet. We're reaching a huge number of people, but not always with, the information that is the most factually accurate.
We have a question from the chat room.
Yay!
Can you see it from Google Earth? Lighter, darker areas, etc.?
You can't, actually. It's completely invisible by satellite. And that's because the plastic pieces are very small and some tend to be, they're a density of somewhere between 2 or 3 and on average pieces per square meter. So that's like a little crumbs floating in a square meter, and we concentrate it with our net and then we can see it. But just from a satellite, you can't see it. I've been trying to think of creative ways and talking with experts in the field of like different wavelengths you might be able to look at to see it. But right now, there's no easy way.
So you say not from satellite, but how about from air?
Not from air either. I mean, certainly there are larger pieces that you can see from the air that are people do use planes to survey, and these are big things like ghost nets. A ghost net is a big hairball of lost fishing debris, and they can be extremely large. You know, these nets that get lost can actually be miles long. Lines, not nets that are miles long, but very large nets as well. So you can survey those by planes, but really more than 90% of the trash that's out there are these very, very small particles. And I would look at my net actually in the water knowing that those particles were going into it and I couldn't see them, or at least not most of them.
So where does all the garbage come from?
The thought is that most of it comes from land and some of it comes from fishing-related activities. There aren't really good numbers on there. There's a statistic floating around out there that 80% comes from land, 20% from ocean activities, that I'm not entirely sure what it's based on. But certainly we know that it is coming from both areas. I mean, you can just see the trash come off California every time after it rains. You can actually like see it washing right into the ocean. And you can also see out there that clearly there's trash that's associated with fishing activities. I want to note that it was actually totally legal to dump plastic in the ocean until 1990, which I find shocking every time I see it. You could just legally throw your trash overboard if you were on a cruise ship. So it became illegal in 1990, but since plastic doesn't really break down, a lot of that trash might still be out there.
We have another question from the chat room.
Doesn't this help reduce global warming because it is made in part of carbon?
Oh, that's a good question.
That was from Greg Layton.
Oh, excellent. You know, I don't know that it really does. It's basically the plastic is oil that didn't get burned, but I don't know that if it wasn't, I don't know that if it was floating in the ocean as opposed to just being dumped in a landfill, I doubt it makes too much difference. Other people have asked me if it affects the albedo of the Earth, like, for example, if the plastic is reflecting more light back into space and thus reducing global warming, but the density is not nearly high enough to have any effect on that.
Now, the other thing that is continually mentioned is that it's bigger than Texas.
Well, you know, before I went on this quiz, I was like, oh, there's no published data really on the full extent. It's something that's hard and expensive to measure because you have to go out there in a ship since, as we said, you can't see it on satellite, can't see it from a plane very easily. So that's quite expensive. But I can tell you now, having processed our samples, it's definitely bigger in one dimension than Texas.
Okay.
The area is a lot more expensive to measure, but in a straight line, we found plastic for 3,000 miles straight that's going out and back, out from San Diego to the middle of the ocean and then back into Oregon. So one-dimensionally, actually, it is bigger than Texas, but I really can't speak for the area that hasn't been measured adequately.
So you say that before you left, you didn't know exactly. What was known about the patch before this research expedition?
Well, there's a nonprofit organization that has really been the one to raise awareness of this, and that is run by a guy named Captain Charles Moore, and the organization is called Algolita Marine Research Foundation. So they have been going out there for about 10 years and saying, hey, there's a lot of trash in the ocean, and, you know, doing some tows and counting up the plastic. But what we were able to do was basically bring the resources of a large oceanographic vessel to bear, which means that we can measure a lot of things at the same time, such as the physical oceanography, which is pretty important to figuring out why there's more and why there's less in certain areas. It does vary a lot. So that's what we were able to do. So as far as I know, we were one of the first research vessels to go out there. There was a University of Hawaii cruise the year before us, so I don't want to be too, you know, boastful. But I think we were able to make a bunch of measurements that haven't been made before.
Audience, if you have questions or comments about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, email live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. We have another email. Actually, sorry, question from the chat room.
What do you think of the plastic expedition?
I'm sorry, you're referring to Plastiki?
Plastiki, yeah.
Yes. Yes, there is for those who don't know, there is a boat that is built out of many, many plastic drinking bottles that is now out sailing to raise awareness of this issue. I definitely think that raising awareness is great, and that I am constantly surprised by both by all the interest in this issue and then by how many people don't know that plastic in the ocean is a problem. So I think that it will be really great if we can get more people to stop using, you know, single-use plastics or to stop, you know, throwing all their stuff in the canyons, as happens in, here in Southern California.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the negative effects of this. What is the effect on the wildlife in the area?
It's rather unclear at the moment. We certainly do know that larger pieces of plastic cause a lot of damage to larger animals such as seabirds, whales, and turtles. So, for example, in those ghost nets that I mentioned, the discarded fishing debris, just because a net isn't being fished by anyone doesn't mean that it stops fishing. It keeps on catching. And then sometimes animals that come in to eat the fish that have been caught then get tangled. So I've heard them referred to as floating walls of death. So those
colorful.
Do tend to entangle. When you hear about whales being entangled, it's usually in fishing debris like that. So those do kill a large number of turtles, birds, and whales. Those larger pieces of debris. We also know that seabirds such as albatross and sea turtles will eat debris. In sea turtles, this can cause intestinal blockage, and albatrosses will feed it to their chicks. We don't know in albatrosses of the that the plastic is directly causing those chicks' death, but it is certainly unpleasant to see. And then, but for the smaller animals, we don't know very much at all. We know that some fish are eating plastic, but we don't know what the effect of that is. I like to say that, you know, I could eat little pieces of plastic right now, and we all know where they'd end up. So, so there's a few steps to proving harm after, even though we do know that some fish are eating the plastic. But the thing that I think is most interesting, which is, I suppose, a little nerdy, but I think it's a huge alteration to the ecosystem, is that we've added all these hard surfaces into this land that has no hard surfaces whatsoever. It's just water. I mean, there's no islands in the eastern part of the Central Pacific. There's nothing between California and Hawaii. There's no hard surfaces for miles around. And now there is actually a lot of the surface area that's available for animals to live on that wouldn't naturally be there. You get different kinds of bacteria, and you get different kinds of invertebrates, such as barnacles or bryozoans. And bryozoans can be really pesky, invasive species. So that's what I'm working on, which is probably why I think it's so interesting. But I think the question of all this hard surfaces could really have an impact on the ecosystem.
Well, actually, we have a related email question.
Is the effect on wildlife wholly negative, or are there some species that are adapting to the changing habitat?
There are definitely some species that are living right on the plastic. The problem is that it's a pretty low diversity community. Only a few organisms are able to do it, and they win. Like gooseneck barnacles and these little crabs that like live right on the plastic, they've made out like it's the lottery. But there's just not very many species that can do that. And so you get this low diversity community with only maybe, I'm just making this up, maybe 20 species of invertebrate, as opposed to the natural zooplankton and fish community, which might have hundreds and hundreds of species, which is a very high diversity community out there. So it's not necessarily, while some animals do win the plastic lottery, most of them is either neutral or they lose.
So before you signed on to the project, what did you think that you were going to find?
When I started looking at this in the scientific literature, I realized there was just not very much information on this at all. And so I had all these elaborate plans for what we would do if we couldn't find any plastic. I mean, the ocean is very big, which I know sounds like a cliche.
No, but exactly.
But it's very big. And I've lost, you know, pieces of equipment just off the coast and never been able to find them again when I had GPS coordinates and everything. So I was like, okay, well, we might not be able to find this plastic. I mean, everything in the ocean tends to be pretty patchy, too. Although it looks like a big blue bathtub, it really has a lot of structure. And not everything is everywhere. So I had like, okay, what are we going to do? If we go out there, we cruise around for 2 weeks and we don't find anything, what are we going to do? What does that mean? So the most surprising thing to me was just the consistency of plastic. Although I said it does vary in amount, but I really did not expect that we would find plastic in 126 out of 126 plankton toes.
So now that you've actually found things, it's not purely anecdotal anymore. What is the research being used for?
Well, we found things. We're still processing the samples, so we don't really have results yet. Basically what you do in a scientific cruise is you put stuff in jars as fast as you possibly can, because the ship time is $20,000 a day. So you want to get as many samples as you can, because who knows when you'll ever get out again.
Whoa, can we just say that again? $20,000
a day.
Ooh.
Yes. This is a medium-sized vessel. The big ones are 40,000.
And how many days were you out there?
We were out there for 3 weeks.
Ooh. All right. Science is expensive.
It is a large amount of money, which is why we really try to make the most of it. It is also why having the opportunity to do this as a student is very special and is not something that is available to most students. We are very fortunate to have a program at Scripps that allows students to apply for their own cruises, which is how we were able to do this. But so essentially what we came back with was hundreds of dead things in jars preserved to look at later. So what I've been doing since we got back is going through that and hand picking out the plastic, measuring it, counting it up. So we're getting, the end is in sight, but it is not there yet. So then we will have results.
Okay, now you say hand picking out the plastic, and you've mentioned a lot about particles of plastic. One of the issues with this is that it is pollution and that we would love to clean this up. How does one go about cleaning up particles of plastic, or do they?
Well, it's certainly a huge technical challenge. As I said, the particles are very small. Again, 90% are less than the size of your tiniest fingernail, and a lot are smaller. That's about the same size as the zooplankton, which are the little animals that live in the ocean, a lot of crustaceans, jellyfish, and the zooplankton is basically fish food. So you don't really want to wipe out all the surface zooplankton.
Right.
It's a huge challenge. If you're going to take out those little pieces of plastic, you're definitely going to take out the zooplankton. I mean, we caught the plastic with nets designed for zooplankton, and I sure did catch a lot of zooplankton as well, which, you know, doesn't bother me very much because I study zooplankton. But you can't really do that for the whole North Pacific. You have a lot of bycatch, and it's very expensive. I mean, as I said, our ship costs $20,000 a day, and that's mostly fuel. So if you're running a vessel that's big enough to pull a big net, then you have significant fuel costs. It becomes tricky to take a sailboat because the gyre, by its nature, is the doldrums. I mean, that's the horse latitudes of yore. See, even if you take a sailboat, you have to motor around in the gyre. So it's a huge challenge. There is a nonprofit group that we collaborated with on this cruise in August called Project Kaisei that is working on this. So I'm quite eager to see what they end up coming up with.
Audience, you can reach us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or on Twitter @skepticalradio. And we'll be right back with more on the Great Pacific Garbage Patch right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, researcher and writer Peter Januszewski joins us to discuss the science of obesity. We'll cut through the hype and dig into the latest research on weight loss and human health. And on Speaking Up, Carrie Ewan of SkepChick.org talks about Skepticon. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time. That's SkepticallySpeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. We're here with Miriam Goldstein, principal investigator on the CPLEX cruise, which investigated plastic debris in the North Pacific Gyre. We have a chat room question.
Are there any other garbage patches in the other oceans?
Yes, there is definitely a garbage patch in the North Atlantic. And that is work that's based on 22 years of data from a group called the Sea Education Association, which is run out of Woods Hole. They are a really fantastic organization that runs tall ships for student education. So they've been sampling this for the last 22 years and have documented a large amount of plastic in the North Atlantic Gyre as well, which is also called the Sargasso Sea. Much less is known about the Southern Hemisphere. I mean, in this and really in everything. So there are reports of plastic in the South Atlantic Gyre off Brazil. Really, very little is known about the Indian Gyre or the South Pacific Gyre. There is an organization called Five Gyres that is aiming to document this. I believe they're out in the Indian Ocean right now. And the interesting thing about the South Pacific Gyre is that it's predicted actually to have a pull that's 4 times stronger than the North Pacific Gyre. So theoretically, there could be really even more trash in the South Pacific because it just has sort of a stronger vortex effect. But we don't know because nobody's ever sampled it.
And another chat room question. The chat room is very active today.
How long will the garbage patch take to go away once we stop adding to it? This is from Greg Leiden.
You know, that's a hard question to answer because we don't have a good way to age the plastic. So I don't know if the little particles that we collected are, 5 years old or 25 years old. So it's something that we're working on, but unfortunately there's no obvious way of doing it. I've been bugging, geochemists and polymer scientists all around, and there's no magical chemical test to say how old a given particle is. So without that knowledge, it's hard to tell how long a little particle is in the patch or if they sink out or if they break down to smaller than we're seeing. So I don't know. But I can tell you, it will certainly keep on getting bigger if we keep on putting more plastic in. So that's definitely the first step, is to stop putting plastic in the ocean if we want to find a solution.
And we have an email question.
Would you say that the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is the worst example of marine pollution? How does it compare to things such as oil spills and seagulls caught in those plastic six-pack things?
Well, I actually am far more concerned about climate change and ocean acidification, because the garbage patch is very disturbing and sad, but the high density of plastic is in one area of the ocean, or maybe five if there's garbage patches in the other gyres. But the negative effects of climate change with the rising temperatures, and particularly of ocean acidification, are just absolutely terrifying to me and every other marine scientist that we know. Ocean acidification is essentially the ocean becoming more acidic as it absorbs carbon emissions. And since almost everything in the ocean is made out of calcium carbonate, that means that it can't form their little bones or shells or carapaces or anything like that. So that's everything from shellfish to some kinds of phytoplankton, to fish and to crabs, everything. So I find that to be absolutely terrifying. The trash is definitely bad. And it may have a big impact on the species that are out where there's lots of trash. Definitely is having a high impact on species like albatross. But ocean acidification could potentially do away with everything, all coral reefs, everything.
And another chat room question.
How might a study of the plastic help us understand ocean currents? I'm thinking of a study involving a freighter that dropped a lot of rubber duckies a while ago.
Yes, that's a famous study. It's done by a physical oceanographer named Curtis Ebesmeyer, who also studied reeboks. He's actually the one who coined the term garbage patch based on how things were floating or how his duckies and his sneakers were floating around. So those have been very valuable in understanding the ocean currents. But actually, there's also a deliberate system of debris, although not really debris. There are these oceanic drifters that are like basically buoys with a little transponder that says, "Here I am." And so there are, I think about 3,000. I might be totally off. There's thousands of them floating around in the ocean right now just saying, "Here I am." And so that is how surface ocean currents are primarily studied with these specialized buoys.
Now, Miriam, I can ask questions again if you all in the chat room are done. No, I do encourage that. When you and I met at Science Online 2010, one of the things that I found so interesting about your presentation was the fact that you used a lot of social media and electronic communication around this to educate the public. Could you sort of talk about some of the things that you did?
Sure. I was basically, as chief scientist, I was drunk with social networking power. And I've been blogging for a couple of years before this cruise came along, and I was like, oh, this is perfect. Perfect opportunity to really bring the public into ocean research. So we, from the ship, were able to blog, send photos, Twitter. We did some Facebooking, but primarily from the ship, we were Twittering, blogging, and sending out photos, which was definitely also a challenge because the internet was routed through the satellite phone, so it was quite expensive to send things. So we're really on small pictures and text, but we had wonderful shore support people that allowed us, who would post things for us, so we didn't have to use the actual internet too much. So it was wonderful to basically to be able to take people out to the middle of the ocean with us and show them what we were seeing. And that was one of my major goals, was to, they could see exactly what we were seeing, which was both to show them that that ocean science is fantastic and cool, and that we saw all these cool animals, like a dead giant squid and a vampire squid and things like that, and also what the garbage patch actually looked like. Which is to say, we didn't see a giant floating dump. We did see plastic particles for thousands of miles.
So was this only one-way communication then, or was it more interactive between the people who were reading your tweets and blog posts and such?
The blog posting was pretty one-way for the people on the ship. We had a graduate student on land who was answering the questions, and then she would relay one she couldn't answer to us by text email, and we would answer back. Twitter was actually ideal for this because it's so low bandwidth. So we were able to interact with the ship live on Twitter since it just is almost nothing in bandwidth. And so that was one of my favorite things to do once we were just steaming back in and didn't have too much work to do, was to go play on the Twitter.
We have another question from the chat room.
Questions from Rockstar Pet. Yes. She mentioned that she went from California to the Jaya and then to Oregon. Does the garbage flow elsewhere around the ocean, or does it flow into other oceans?
I'm sorry, do you mean that is there garbage in other places in the ocean, or is the garbage in the gyre going someplace else?
I'm assuming that, yes, the garbage in the gyre, does it eventually go somewhere else?
Unless it sinks, no. It's a dead end for things that float. Which is why we think that there's so much trash there, because it is that kind of an accumulation zone. There certainly is trash in other places in the ocean, but it's usually going somewhere, for example, to the gyre. So when you drop a bottle off of California, or you drop a bottle or any place on the west coast of North America, and you drop a bottle off anywhere on the east coast of Asia, if it doesn't sink, it's eventually going to go to the gyre.
And another chat room question.
This from KO. Yes. Are the currents that make up these gyres permanent features, or do they change over time?
The large-scale features, so basically the general currents are permanent. They're driven by the trade winds and the westerlies. But they certainly do change from year to year, moving a little bit north or a little bit south. So you can't go to a given set of coordinates and say this is the highest density of trash, but you can, on average, say that, you know, these currents are more or less always the same, and so this general area is the highest level of trash. I hope that made sense.
You know, this is a very popular show, Miriam. We have, I'm not asking any of my questions because I actually, we're receiving a lot of emails here. So next email question.
Climate change has polar bears. Are there any species that the Great Pacific Garbage Patch can claim as its specific victims?
I think that albatross tend to be the poster critter for the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. And that's because albatross are true oceanic birds. They're wonderful birds. They have a 10-foot wingspan. They're huge. And they can lock their wings so they can actually fly for days without flapping. And so they spend months and months and months out at sea. And they're scavengers. They eat anything that's on the surface. So they are definitely eating this trash. And in the case of when they reproduce, they're bringing the trash back and feeding it to their chicks. So you can see lots of pictures of chicks that have died, that have plastic in their stomach. The open question now is if this plastic is actually killing them. Like most seabirds, most albatross chicks die. If you live to be an adult and you're an albatross, then you can live for 100 years. I mean, really, they live a really long time. But a lot of them die as chicks. So one of the researchers who was actually on the CPLEX expedition, Andrew Titmus, is looking at this specifically and trying to find out if he can directly link plastic ingestion to death in albatross chicks. But they're definitely one of the most charismatic animals that are out there in the gyre. People have called it an oceanic desert, and that's true. It's not very productive, which it's not like the coastal ecosystem with this teeming with lots and lots of big fish, or used to be anyway. Out of the gyre, it's very nutrient poor, so it's hard for the little plants to grow, and then you don't get a lot of big fish. But like a desert, the animals that live out there are very specialized and cool and used to living in a place where it's hard to make a living. So, I mean, I think there should be like poster jellyfish and like poster sea snails and things like that. But
I would buy that poster. This is going to be our last email question.
Questions from Rick McPherson. He asks, some may say that the enormous media attention on the Garbage Patch draws attention away from perhaps more urgent pressing ocean issues. I think the ocean can use all the attention they can get, but what is your opinion on this?
I do worry about this because, as I said before, I worry about trash, but I really, really worry about ocean acidification. But in general, I think that it's probably positive. Most people don't think about the ocean very much at all. Most people are not fortunate enough to live like right on the ocean, or they only get to visit it once a year. And when they do visit it, they think it's all just like a beach. In fact, my husband thought this before I educated him, that the ocean was just endless sand forever and ever, with like a coral reef plunked down somewhere in the middle, but like barely not a whole lot going on. But I think this issue has brought attention to the fact that the ocean has all this crazy cool life in it, and that is periled by human activities. So just getting that message across is amazing. Getting people to care about the Central Pacific ecosystems is really, really amazing. And so I'm hoping that the ocean conservation community as a whole can take this attention and also bring it to bear on other causes besides trash.
Well put.
Thank you.
You know, and I was looking forward to having enough time to maybe ask you a little bit about the nasty invertebrate sex that you and I spoke about before the show, but we don't have time, so I will definitely ask you back on to talk about that. And excellent. That's our time for the day. Thank you so much, Miriam.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed being on.
So, everybody, you can find more from Miriam at deepseanews.com, and you can find more from us at skepticallyspeaking.com. And from there, you can join our Facebook group, follow us on Twitter, and subscribe in iTunes. And I just want to say thank you so much to everybody, and especially those people in the chat room that just posted that fan page and screwed me right up before the show. That looks beautiful. So everyone, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week for another year of Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. You called tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who, I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
On Skeptically Speaking, we discuss a wide range of skeptical and science topics with a variety of experts. But I'd like to remind you that you, yes, you personally, are invited to join us on air every week for Speaking Up. Because let's face it, outreach is a part of skepticism. We all do it, whether we're talking to our parents about why they shouldn't buy into that multi-level marketing scheme, explaining the misinformation around vaccines to our coworkers, or forwarding that Snopes entry on why typing in your PIN number backward on the ATM machine does not, in fact, summon the police. But if you want to take your skeptical activism one step further and reach a broader audience, we're here for you. Do you have an event coming up that you'd like to promote? Or maybe you're a blogger that's been doing some great work and you'd like to talk about it? Or you'd just like to get some experience speaking publicly on a science or skeptical topic? What better way to get some real-world practice than on a friendly, rational radio show? If you're ready to have your say, do send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put Speaking Up in the subject line, tell us a bit about what you'd like to discuss, and we'll contact you to set up your very own 10 to 15 minutes of on-air goodness. We're looking forward to hearing from you.